Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
Let me just contextualize a little bit what we're going to do in these four lectures, as I see it, or engagements. In the 13th century, Thomas Aquinas was certainly the most important, prolific, and influential theologian. He was not the only major theologian. I mean, there was St. Bonaventure, St. Albert the Great. These people were prolific. They were saints. They were beautiful writers and thinkers. But Aquinas was a real important moment in the history of theology for thinking more deeply about the mystery of grace, which we'll come to and talk about in a minute. And you can study grace throughout many of his works, and you know, in the Summa Theologiae, there's a lot on grace in different places. However, that all being said, there's one place in the first part of the second part, the Prima Secundae, of the famous Summa Theologiae, where he talks about grace in these, basically in these seven or so questions. And what we've done is we've taken them and given you the, you know, the core parts of them. I'm not today, this evening, I'm not going to really read from the text. Tomorrow, I think the text I'm going to present to you is short enough that I might actually just read through it with you, or parts of it. It follows a logical order. I'm not really going to try to explain that. I have been commenting on this text, as I know Father Dominic has also, for about 10 years, teaching it every year, and I've always found more in it. So this is like just a first introduction. It's supposed to be accessible. If it's not accessible, you know, maybe we'll not have succeeded, but I think it will be. And so part of the idea is to give you kind of the big picture of what's going on. I want to begin, so there's a lot of ways you could do this historically. You could say, who had taught what before Thomas Aquinas? What did he do that was original? There is a lot that he does in this little treatise that's original. So it's not like just everybody wrote things exactly like this and he was just, you know, copying everybody else. He is in conversation with a lot of other people. You could talk about that. You could talk about how this text has been interpreted after him in the history of theology. I'll allude to some ideas like that, but I'm just trying to get you right into the main core ideas as a first impression. How does Aquinas see human nature and grace? What is grace? Why do we need grace? And so forth. Just to give you a fundamental definition, it's something that the Father Irenaeus said today in Mass. When he defines grace at one point in the text of the Summa Theologiae, Aquinas talks about it in terms of where it comes from, what it does in us formally, and what effect it creates in us. Kind of like you say, the efficient cause or origin, the formal cause or essence, and the final cause or effect. And he says, it comes from God. So in a way, grace is just God himself sharing his life with us. It's God who wants to grant us a participation in his own life and nature. So the mystery of grace is the mystery of receiving God, or receiving life in God, eternal life, elevation into the nature, the divine nature. In another sense, it's something in us. We could talk about it as created grace, and that's really what we're focusing on mostly these days. It's something God gives us that, you might say, he plants in our soul that sprouts up through faith, hope, and charity that allows us to live with God. It's like the inward motion that makes us friends with God. And its final effect, he says, is to render us grateful, or to make us people of gratitude or gracefulness, giving thanks for what we are and what we've received, and rendering thanks to God, returning to God, you might say, in friendship. Well, that's a very basic idea, but God is giving himself to you. That's what grace is. God is giving you new capacities to love and to know him and love him and hope in him. And that's grace transforming you inwardly, and God is rendering you kind of relative to him in gratitude and friendship, turning upward into God. And that's a kind of a final effect of grace. So I'm going to present today, I'm going to talk about question 9. What's weird is, you know, they're called questions, but they're composed, the questions of the Summa Theologiae are all composed of articles. The articles are all questions, right? So it's kind of counterintuitive, but basically the question means the big subject heading, and then under it is a whole bunch of little questions we call articles. And in the treatise on grace, the first question he asks is grace necessary? And this is a kind of philosopher's question. I mean, why should I even care? What do I need the grace for? Why am I even worried about this? How should it be that we should be interested in this? What's at stake? And that's a pretty important question to start with. What's even at stake in this discussion? And Aquinas is going to basically argue for two reasons we need grace in question 109. In articles 1 through 4, and I'm not going to read them all, just telling you the big picture. This is like the first view from 20,000 feet up. It's grace heals nature. So the premise here is our nature is wounded. Our good old human nature, which has, Aquinas is going to say a lot of good things about human nature that I'm about to talk about. He's going to avoid a catastrophic view of human nature, but he is going to present a sober view of human nature as wounded and say there's some things wrong with us that need to be healed, and we can't heal it all by ourselves or all together. We can't just create the best philosophy, the best political system, get more scientific data, work harder, try harder. No, can't do all that. We need grace. And then questions 5 through 10 are going to be about elevating grace, like going higher, getting somewhere you can't get by your own power, taking the elevator up into God that will lift you up where you cannot go on your own. So, you know, in terms of motivation, why do I need grace? Why should I even care about this mysterious things that Christians talk about as grace? I need it to heal my wounded nature. I need to elevate my nature so I can know God and live in friendship with God. Now, he's, in this first part here, going to try to avoid two extremes. And I'm going to put them under the auspices of how he would have thought of them in the 13th century. One is what he knows of as Pelagianism. Pelagianism is the 5th century heresy or theological opinion that Augustine wrote against of Pelagius and Gelasius, who were fellows who were very ascetical monks who thought that human nature could basically be healed by its own powers, and that you didn't need grace to observe all the commandments of God. It's basically the idea our nature is functional enough that once the Bible's like an external indication. I look off onto the Bible or into divine revelation on the example of Christ and say, oh, that's how it's supposed to be. Okay, I can do that. I'll just imitate Christ, and with the, you know, restored nature that I have now when I see how I ought to live, I'll do the right thing and I'll get myself together and I'll be able to do all that's within my natural power. Now, I mean, Pelagianism was getting going in the 5th century, and Augustine wrote against it, and then the church had a kind of took consciousness of the woundedness of our human nature. But, you know, in the Enlightenment era of the 18th century, effectively, I mean, Pelagianism self-consciously comes back very strongly in Rousseau and Kant and these people who say, not only can we really do things by our natural power, and dependence on something called grace is a problem, but also we shouldn't be trying to know things that are supposedly supernatural or revealed by God. We need to stay within the boundaries of reason alone and not be presumptuous about these crazy religious claims that monks and nuns have thought up in the Middle Ages and imposed on us through religious authority and violence. So, you know, Pelagianism is not at all a dead option. I would say it's well and alive. And there's like more naive forms of skepticism, say, well, why should I believe in divine revelation? But then there's more acute forms from the Enlightenment. People say, I don't think we should be going off and chasing revelations. We should stay within the boundaries of nature alone. Aquinas is acutely aware of this temptation. He considers it a kind of meta-temptation. But then on the other side, he's aware of very pessimistic Augustinianism. Now, Augustine is a Augustinian. He has read Augustine. He follows Augustine. But he has an interpretation of Augustine on being a fallen human being, being a sinner of need and redemption, original sin. He believes in all that. But he knows there are certain readings of Augustine going on out there, often in the Franciscan Priory across the street in Paris, that are, he considers, a bit too dour, a bit too extreme. And, you know, there's a range of opinions permitted. But he's worried about a kind of too pessimistic view of human nature. Right? So on the one side, you could say it's mitigated pessimism. He doesn't want you to think you can do everything by your own powers, heal yourself, save yourself, all that stuff. He also has a mitigated pessimism. He doesn't want us trashing human nature, and he doesn't know about like the Lutheran idea of radical depravity, but Aquinas is not a radical depravity person. He's much more closer to what the Council of Trent will talk about in terms of having a wounded human nature. But there are other views in the Catholic Church at the time of Aquinas and afterwards, some of which are closer to Luther and Calvin. Okay, so then I'm not going to read the articles, but I want to now go through and just kind of give you the view from 30,000 feet up, you know, topic of what goes on. So it's interesting. He asks first, whether without grace man can know any truth. So this is the question about how healthy is our intellect? How healthy is our intellect without grace? So just to take an interesting example, when you look at Zwingli, writing in the 16th century, you know, the contemporary of Luther, who's one of the first reformers. Zwingli argues very clearly, I mean, I think with wonderful clarity, that because of the fall, the human intellect is so wounded, we can know nothing really of God or of what human nature is. And that has a very contemporary feel to it. You know, like you look at how your contemporaries who are not very religious, do they really know what human nature is? They've got a lot of sort of idea they can renovate the whole idea of what human nature is. I can maybe redefine it, maybe the Supreme Court can redefine it. But the, you know, the question of whether you can like philosophically know God, right, that seems pretty daunting for a lot of people. Okay, so Aquinas understands you can take, that's after Aquinas, but he, you know, he's aware that you can take a very skeptical view of the fallen human intellect. There's the old saying that for Augustine, fallen human beings have darkened minds and disordered desires. Darkened minds and disordered desires. You know, that can be a very liberating thought if you're like working out under the pressure of an extraordinarily moral like sentiment of your own obligations and impotence. You know, like, oh, I can't do all this, I can't do all this. Yes, that's right, because you have a darkened mind and disordered desires. Oh, thank God. I feel so much better now knowing I'm a fallen human being. Well, Aquinas is going to say that the intellect retains, basically, after the fall, it retains its natural power. This is partly because he's an Aristotelian. He thinks the agent intellect is supported by God after the fall with capacity for insight, reasoning. And so Aquinas thinks like all the university forms of knowledge, the sciences, as they would have called them, not just mathematics or observational sciences, but philosophy, and ethics, you know, there's a certain amount human beings can do because they have a human nature. So Aquinas thinks you can learn a lot from pagans. You can learn a lot from humanists. You can learn a lot from people who are just trying to work things out in their natural mind by observational sciences and mathematics. However, he also holds that you use your mind, and okay, so let me just say one more thing. You know, he thinks you can obtain some pretty important knowledge philosophically of what a human being is, of human ethics, and even of God. He thinks the pagan philosophers got some things, a lot of things wrong about God, but they got some things right. So, I mean, Aquinas has what you might call a kind of moderate optimism about the intellect in the fallen human world. But where he's more sober is about the will. He thinks the will is much more distended and confused, like our loves are very problematic with like figuring out what we should love and how we should live and what we should want. And so actually this affects our intellect. You know, if the intellect is like a light that you can shine on things and then study them and go into them and like get into the grit of them and discover them, the light points where you want it. And the heart is pointing the light at things it wants, its appetites, its desires. So, you know, think about what people major in. I mean, that's a pretty innocuous thing. You can major in a lot of stuff, and it's hard to go wrong, really. You're going to study something that you can know something about. But, like, what are they ultimately going for? I want to be a dentist. I know some of you probably have family members who are dentists. I live in Rome, so I come back here twice a year. So for me, a dentist is a very important person. You know, like, it's my big highlight of my trip to Washington. I can see an American dentist. But I don't take the dentist for granted. But, you know, most people are not going just for the dentistry. Maybe it is just interesting and fascinated by it, but often it's like a pretty lucrative and monetarily stable way of making income. So they want the money. What do you want the money for? Well, I want the house. What do you want the money in the house for? I want the family. Okay. We can ask those questions of what we're desiring. So for Aquinas, the pursuit of knowledge is often about, like, what are you trying to get to? Where are you trying to go with that? And the pursuit of knowledge can become something that leads you away, actually, from God or true knowledge of the human person. You know? So that can happen in more innocuous ways or in, like, deep ways. And then sometimes even you can try to prove God doesn't exist or ignore God because it's a very inconvenient thesis. You know, like, I don't want God. I mean, it can get that deep in somebody. I don't want God, so I don't. So, I mean, Aquinas is very, like, kind of optimistic about what the intellect can do, but he comes back with a kind of sober side about the will, where the will can move the intellect kind of in different directions. So then in Article 2, he asks, can a man wish or do any good without grace? Can I will any single good in life without grace? So this is taking natural fallen human beings wounded by original sin, which I'm not going into what original sin is here, but we're all in some way, for Aquinas, following St. Paul, affected by the first sin, the sin of our first ancestors, and by our life without grace. We're born without grace, born deprived of original righteousness. So our nature is weak and uncoordinated. The harmony of the spiritual powers and the sensate powers of the animal in us, it's not very complete harmony. So we can easily fall into, like, the primacy of the senses, or, you know, and we also have, like, selfish tendencies, and we have things we're not lucid about. We suffer from ignorance individually and collectively as a human race. So, can we do any good action whatsoever? Now, there are people in the tradition getting going with a really pessimistic view here. And, I mean, two centuries later, an Augustinian monk named Gregory of Rimini will argue very clearly, like, every act you do, if you're a fallen human being, if you're fallen without grace, every act you do is sinful. Because there's always some deep self-referentiality. It's like so narcissistic. Everybody's so narcissistic in the fallen world that everything they're doing ultimately for themselves in a disordered way. And so there's always some kind of deep, grave self-referentiality in the sinner, in the person who's not saved grace. That's a really sobering thought. And there's something, like, terrifyingly realistic about it. Like, if your heart's not set on God in the state of grace, can you really ever not be fundamentally a raw, selfish person? And aren't you really kind of, in a way, manipulating everybody in part toward yourself and for yourself in everything you do? I mean, Gregory means to say, yes, that's right. And in a certain way, you're always doing something pretty wicked or sinful without grace healing you. And even when you have grace and you're starting to get going, but in the better direction, but you're still pretty warped. So that sobriety is out there in the Christian Catholic culture. And incidentally, I mentioned Rimini because Luther read Rimini. And then Luther's view is very similar. It's just interesting to see these genealogies. Luther derives a lot of his pessimism, because Luther and Calvin are very clear. In a fallen state, anything you do will be sinful in some respect. It's very sobering. I've read the passages in the Institutes of Christian Religion of Calvin, and I'm a great admirer of Calvin's logic and clarity, but I mean, that is a theology of radical depravity. Okay, Aquinas, who comes earlier, is going to say something very different. And he's going to say, actually, a lot of our natural actions in the fallen world are just basically, in the will, pretty intricately good. In other words, we can do a lot of good just in terms of ordinary life. We can go for natural goods. You know, you can feed a woman can feed her children at home who's not in a state of grace. A woman who's not in a state of grace can feed her children because she loves them. People can pay their taxes because they have a sense of civic justice. People can, you know, maintain obligations at work. They can conduct responsible academic lives. They can obey the rules of driving in order to protect their life and the lives of other people. Okay, so a lot of basic goods can be pursued intact even by a person who's not in a state of grace. And that's like not surprising for Aquinas because nature has a pretty strong endurance, even in a wounded human being. So even in a human being marked by selfishness, some narcissism, some bad orientations of the will, and no real vibrant love of God, maybe, you know, a person who's culpably like alienated from God or atheistic or non-religious or whatever it is, caught up in superstition or ridiculous like delusions, whatever it is, there's still a lot of good nature in them and they can basically do a lot of good things. Okay, so the Aquinas again soberly optimistic here. Then he asks in Article 3 whether by his own natural powers and without grace man can love God above all things. Okay, so he goes, like, if you look at the order of this, he starts with, can you know any good without God's special grace? Yeah, you can know a lot of things. You can't know the life of God in himself. You can't know the Blessed Trinity. You can't know Jesus Christ personally. You can't understand Christ's presence in the Eucharist. That's all elevation and intellect by grace. But your human nature can still know a lot of natural truth. And you can will a lot of natural good. Can you love God above all things? Now, this is really important. Aquinas is not talking about, Aquinas distinguishes two ways we can love God. One is by nature and the other is by grace. Now, the mystery of the love of God by grace is what we call in the Catholic tradition charity, or agape in Greek, caritas in Latin, charity in English. This is God pouring the love of the Holy Spirit into our hearts so that we can love God the Father and Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit by grace. It's a mystical love. You don't have to feel it. It's not necessarily emotional. You don't have to sense it. You can only just sometimes, I mean, sometimes just believe in it. But it's there in us. By baptism, if we're in a state of grace, if we're in friendship with God, we can mystically, in the darkness of faith, know Christ, love Christ, know the Father, love the Father, know the Holy Spirit, love the Holy Spirit. It may not seem obvious, but it can grow in us. That's a divine love. It's a mystery. But Aquinas says God cannot give us that grace of mystical love, of friendship with God, of this elevating charity, unless we already have a natural predisposition in us at a lower level to love God above all things. Because otherwise, charity would do violence to our nature. It would be like taking an aardvark. Right, God would take the aardvark. You should love me above all things. Right? The aardvark is oblivious. I can only sense the, in this case, the hands of my little image of God that's anthropomorphic, holding it. It can't even perceive the transcendent nature of God by reason. It doesn't have any capacity. Right, so it's kind of cruel to ask the aardvark to love God above all things. But it would be, in a way, cruel for us, even crueler for us as rational animals. Like, imagine that all we could, like, the highest science was mathematics. Right? You take the mathematician, the total nerd mathematician, you say, you must love God above all things. It's contrary to my reason. It doesn't fit into mathematics. Charity is not mathematizable. You're doing violence to my mind. Right? So Aquinas actually feels the weight of that, you know, of that objection. He's like, okay, no, human reason's got to be somehow naturally open to God, and we're naturally able to prefer God to all other goods. Not by the divine higher love of supernatural charity, the mystical love that God gives you by grace, but just by natural capacity to love God. And you're like, okay, that sounds really good, but like in my university there's classes on calculus, but there's not classes on natural love of God. Now, Aquinas actually writes about the natural love of God philosophically as a philosopher, but he's not surprised that it doesn't show up in the curriculum of the ancient Greeks. Like, why didn't Aristotle write a treatise on this? Because he says, in the fallen world, it's really hard to access this part of ourselves if we aren't healed by grace. So basically, he says, can you love God naturally above all things without grace? No. How does he know that? He knows that based on the fact that the scriptures teach that human beings are, in a way, errant or confused morally in their relationship with God because of the absence of grace, because of the reality of the fall and our human nature's wounds. So our hearts don't quite work right. And in this article, which is an awesome article, which, you know, I usually, like, if I have the time, I take an hour to comment Article 3. Because he talks about, like, the common good and the private good. And he says, so the common good is, like, let's say you're interested in studying Thomas Aquinas. Like, it's a lot easier to do in a group with other people who are interested, like, with people who know a little bit more about him. So we're experiencing a little modest common good right now. Or like you say, you want to eat dinner with other people, you don't eat dinner alone, right? So it's more social. That's a common good. You have to have other people to do that. But what's the ultimate common good? What if you put everything together that is worth participating in? Is it like the city? Because that includes this and like pizza, you know, having dinner with people and like studying with other people and families and universities. It's all fit in the city. Or is it the nation state? Or is it the cosmos? Aquinas actually says the ultimate common good is God, because God is the greatest good, sustaining every other good in being and inviting you into communion with Him. And so this is like a really, you know, 25th story above the earth or 50th story above the earth kind of vision. Like, we're meant to ultimately go be part of the largest, greatest common good available that actually is God. And everything else exists for God. But the problem with sin is it makes you want to do everything in a way for the more proximate good of self. Aquinas thinks you need to love yourself, and that one of the effects of original sin is we don't love ourselves the right way. We love ourselves more than God, and we don't really love ourselves the way we should love ourselves. So we also have a problem with not loving ourselves. One of the weird things about original sin is you love yourself too much in the wrong way and not enough in the right way, so you both are insecure and don't love yourself, and you also have trouble loving yourself in the wrong way too much and preferring yourself to other people. We're very complicated.
So he studies that. He sees that, and he's talking about it, diagnosing it. So there he's sober, right? So like on the minimal level, can we do good things without grace? Yes. But can we love God above all things without grace? No.
Which means we're like needing grace to get into some kind of ultimate trajectory. Like if you're saying, well, what's it all about? What am I living for? If God's really what we're supposed to live for, then we really need grace on this point. Because, you know, paying our taxes, opening doors for people, you know, using polite language in our professional circumstance, waiting in line patiently to get on Delta Airlines, and boarding with your right boarding group. That is not the summit of human existence.
But Aquinas is going to say, like, the summit is, like, communion with God, and you can't get there. Your nature's wounded. You're not going to be able to. So, like, motivation, like, I don't know about this whole religion thing. This is, like, this is not so tangible. And it's kind of far removed from my immediate experience, and it seems like a lot of work. Yeah. That's right. Aquinas is like, he's there with you. He's like, yes, it's this, like, loving God above all things is going to require a grace. It's going to take work. And that's one of the reasons the sacraments are helpful and life with others in the Christian church. Then he asks whether any person without grace by his own natural powers can fulfill all the commandments of the law. Now, when he says all the commandments of the law, he means the Ten Commandments.
The medieval church takes the Ten Commandments to be indicative of the natural law. Do not kill people. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not lie. Do not covet what others have. Honor God and love Him above all things, and keep the Sabbath, meaning worship God in a regular, habitual way. Okay, can I do all that by my own natural powers? If it's the natural law, if it involves something that's common to our nature, shouldn't our nature be able to do that? Well, that's exactly where Pelagius said, yeah, I can do all that. I can do all that. I can obey all those Ten Commandments. I will not lie. I will not commit adultery. I will not steal. I will worship God regularly. Try harder, people. And Augustine, who had a great deal of experience in the realm of human sinfulness, said, you can't do all this by your own power. You have to be trained and saved. You have to be saved by grace. You have to be helped by grace. We're too weak. There's too much fragility in us. So Aquinas knows his stories about Pelagius and Augustine, and he says, no, we cannot keep the whole Ten Commandments by our own natural power. Now, he doesn't get into the details and say, you know, like, here's a famous question, famous Catholic question. Can a pagan man or woman who marries and is never in a state of grace or doesn't entertain relationship with grace, can they be faithful to their spouse for life without the help of grace? Can they by nature be chaste and, you know, faithful in marriage for life?
And I think Aquinas thinks that it's possible. He thinks, I think he's clear that people will perform. So when I say possible, it doesn't mean it will always happen. Clearly it doesn't always happen. But I think he does think that
nature is pretty strong in marriage. Like marriage, there is a natural inclination to marry. And some people, it's not maybe the majority, but some people might just by their nature get through like a life of marital fidelity. It doesn't mean they've never committed mortal sin. It doesn't mean they've never committed mortal sin. But he thinks nature can do a lot. But that being said, it's going to be a lot easier for people to live a lifelong marriage for Aquinas if they're in a state, if they're like seeking to live in friendship with God mutually in a state of grace, practicing the sacramental life.
Although that's not a guarantee either, but it's going to help them, you know, and avoid temptation and so forth. So, I mean, that's a classic case. Can you have a pagan who's honest and who doesn't lie?
You know, like an honest pagan politician who's not in a state of grace. I think Aquinas thinks you can get people who are habitually truth-telling. But it's going to be easier if you're, like, examining your conscience to stay in a state of grace and, like, to live in friendship with God in a state of grace.
So then if I turn to these questions about getting into friendship with God, a lot of this is about getting out of the wobbliness and the confusion of sin and getting into the strength and vibrancy of friendship with God. And so he says, can you merit everlasting life without grace? This is basically, can you launch yourself into it? Okay, I'm sold on the whole grace thing. All right, I want to be friends with God. You know, I'd like to be a saint. What do I do first? Well, first, make an effort. Do your best. Work hard at it, and maybe God will give you grace. Right, that's also Pelagian. That's actually called semi-Pelagianism. And that has to do with arguments between French monks in the 6th century who thought, well, okay, you need grace to be saved, but you make the first effort, then God gives you grace. And a disciple of Augustine's, Prosper of Aquitaine, wrote a copious amount against this idea. Even to get into friendship with God, God has to take the first initiative. Paradigm case is baptism, especially infant baptism. Augustine uses that example. What did you do? What did the baby do, right? You know, imagine the priest holding the little baby. Now, try harder. Right?
So, Augustine uses that as the case to say, this is really indicative of what's happening to all of us. We are like the child who, like, doesn't even know yet to consent. You're given grace before you can consent, and it moves you inwardly, disposes you even before you reach the age of reason. So he says, you know, even the adult convert is first moved to incline toward God and to search God or to be curious about God or to be open in some way because of a prior grace given. And then, you know, whether a man by himself and without external aid of grace can prepare himself for grace. So now he's talking about whether, like, you can prepare yourself for what's called, we'll talk about later, I think Father Legge will talk about, the grace of justification.
Basically, there's preparatory graces, which is sometimes called prevenient, which is like where you're still,
or he's thinking of the adult. The paradigm case here is usually the adult convert. The adult convert who goes from, like, obliviousness with human wounds and fragilities and some sinfulness to, like, being in a state of grace. And the oblivious guy, we'll make him a guy. So the oblivious guy
can receive a grace that's prevenient, meaning preparatory, still not in a state of grace, but that prepares the person to then make an integral confession or receive baptism and be restored to a state, be placed in a state of grace for the first time, to receive the influx of grace, to have grace poured into their heart and mind so they live in friendship with God. Or if they're baptized as an infant, but have strayed or been oblivious, they can receive grace to, like, go to confession and receive friendship with God. Yeah.
What if, like, the people don't get grace, like, by other people? Like, what if they just don't know or understand? Like, don't they still deserve grace from God and, like, friendship with God, even though they don't, like, get that help?
Well, okay, so you asked two different questions, and they're both awesome questions, which are totally at the core of the Catholic tradition. One is, does
God offer grace to all people? And the other thing he said, I mean, don't they deserve grace? The second one's a lot more complicated. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of views about restricted atonement theory or restricted great offer of grace. There's been debates about it in the Catholic tradition, but in the Catholic Church, there's a fairly clear doctrinal clarification that because the New Testament teaches that Christ has died for all, so we must believe that in some way, mysteriously, God offers grace to all people. That doesn't mean all people cooperate with it, or that if they begin to cooperate with it, that they will persevere, or that if they are at some point in the state of friendship and grace with God, they can never lose it. That's in the Catholic tradition. You can lose the state of grace. It's not like a once saved, always saved kind of thing. Like,
even with sacraments?
Well, if they persevere in the sacramental life, then there's a kind of practical certitude that they'll be saved. If they're inward, I mean, you can't prove the person's cooperating with the sacrament completely soundly, but typically if they're like, yeah, persevering in the...
So even if they get the sacrament, they can still not get the grace.
Well, you could have a simulation.
Or lose it.
I mean, you could have just give a crazy example. You could have this person simulating sincerity. So the young man married the old widow with the fortune. But she said, you know, the condition is you have to be a baptized Catholic. And he, having read a lot of Nietzsche, understood that he was living beyond good and evil. But he definitely thought the widow's fortune he thought the widow's fortune was a kind of good, and he practiced the sacraments with her devotedly and went to his first Saturday confession and da 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 until the day he was hit by the truck. And she said, oh, this is the guy who was saved, so wonderful, and a giant Catholic funeral. But was he sincere, or did he just want to inherit the fortune? I mean, in the history of the world, such things have happened, alas. So, I mean, that's a kind of scruple case, but it's a good case to illustrate that the external act of belief in the sacrament corresponds to an internal, real faith, hope, and love of God. But presuming that people are trying to live that inner life, the sacraments provide a practical certitude, okay? The other question about deserving grace, though, is like a more complicated, because, I mean, in a way, we could say, like, it would be a shame for God to say, because of original sin and the woundedness of all human beings, that he's going to abandon some prima facie without giving the offer of grace to them. On the other side, the people he gives grace to, meaning me or others or everyone, they do bad things. And, like, they can, like, it's not, I mean, there is the possibility of forfeiting grace in ways that are, like, truly, it's possible to act toward God and other people in truly unjust ways and to forfeit grace through our own, you might say, just deserts.
What about, like, baptism? Like, can you, like, truly forfeit that grace when you don't
practice the faith?
Or, like, have the, like you said, that the babies don't have, like, the capacity, like, the, what's it called? The permission to get the grace.
Right.
Yeah. So the grace of baptism gives you two things for Catholic traditional theology. The first is the character, which is ineffaceable. And that is a disposition to engage in sacramental worship that allows you to receive the other sacraments. So even someone who sins against grace afterwards in their mature life and loses the life of grace retains the character. You never rebaptize people when they come back to the faith. There might be questions of dubious baptism where under condition you rebaptize, or where the baptism wasn't done in the proper way, you rebaptize, but are baptized for the first time. But generally you presume the validity of baptism if you have sufficient evidence of that. The character is ineffaceable. The second thing you receive is the infused habits of faith, hope, and charity, and the infused moral virtues, which we can talk more about. The baby gets them into its spiritual soul, but they're like habits. So they're not exerted yet. That's why there have to be parents and godparents to educate and tease out the acts. The child's never yet performed an act of faith, but it now can recognize Christ. It can recognize Christ if Christ is pointed out to it. So you teach a child, there's a chair, there's a dog, there's a man, and one day the child starts saying, chair, mama, chair, mama, dog, right? Because it has a habitual capacity to recognize abstractly natures. But it can't just do that for Jesus. Mama Jesus, Mama Mary, Mama Eucharist, Mama Church, you can't do that. That's supernatural. And that's where the infused habits of faith, hope, and charity are going to allow it to not just learn the language of Mama pointing at the tabernacle saying, look, Jesus, but associated with that, it will begin to perceive the presence of Jesus by grace.
Gotcha.
But that has to be teased out of it. When the adult convert receives the grace, which you can receive, often the adult convert starts to get this before baptism, they start to have the habit of faith, and they say, you know, Jesus is somehow really present in the tabernacle. I better be baptized.
Can you tease out that faith, that grace, or like that natural good, even if they are baptized? Because, like, God...
It's a supernatural good.
Oh, okay.
Above nature. Super means above. So, I mean, Christ is... Knowing Christ is above the capacities of our mere nature. It's a super. It's a good for our nature, but it's a supernatural good in that sense. It can be given to us prior to baptism. Otherwise, no one would ever ask for baptism. But baptism intensifies and stabilizes, and you move from a kind of prevenient grace to an infused grace of justification. And that's what he's saying. You need grace to carry you along. And then he says, if you, let me just summarize, I'll take more questions, but let me just, because this is a good segue. If you sin against grace, which everyone does, you know, can you rise from sin without grace? You know, you're like, okay, I'm in a state of grace, but I kind of still, you know, kind of still like robbing banks.
I know, it's like endangering people's lives. I did once kill a policeman, but you know, only a confession afterwards. And I do like doing it. And the thing is, God is so merciful that every time I rob that bank, I know he's going to give me forgiveness of my sins. Right? So that's called presumption.
So, I mean, Aquinas is going to say, you have to receive a new initiative of grace to restore you to friendship with him if you sin seriously against the grace you've already received. Doesn't mean God doesn't do it. I mean, that's one of the things that confession does actually guarantee you if you go through it loyally. All you have to renounce the sin of bank robbery.
This is where Graham Greene's novels, this is where Graham Greene like lived, because he had huge problems with very strange and serious sexual addiction. But, you know, what he's interested in is how, like, going to confession with the presumption you're going to sin again can be, like, on the line. And he also probably did engage in espionage. He had deep kind of sympathies with communism. He has all these characters who are like caught up in communist espionage. I mean, he was probably himself a little bit like this. Anyway, so there's like these weird, he's fascinated by the power to sin knowing that you can still get forgiveness. It's not very healthy. And it's really the danger line of presumption. But that's the kind of morose habits of mind that Aquinas is trying to kind of warn us about and say, don't be too presumptuous that God's going to always give you more grace if you just sin more or something. Sin more so you receive more grace or whatever. That's fanciful. The aim is to go into the higher life of friendship with God, not use mercy as a permission to live a mediocre life. And then he says, can you, without grace, avoid sin? And, I mean, this is very important. He says, like, even in a state of friendship with God, when you're in a state of habitual friendship with God, justification and sanctification, you're still going to commit venial sins because of the weakness of the fallen will. Venial sins are precisely sins that don't destroy the relationship with God, but they're still habitually weak. It's like habitual movements of weakness. So this is the teaching later of the Council of Trent that, like, even in the just, there are venial sins. So there's no such thing as a sinless Christian. But the stronger thing, the other thing that's there that's kind of strong, which is that, like, with grace, you can actually avoid mortal sin. So it's possible to live a life without grave sin.
With struggle and with assiduousness of faith in God and love of God and hope in God. And then he says you can't persevere into eternal life without grace. So there's all this other nuance in here. Like, I'll just finish with this. If you go over to the third part of the Summa and you look at Aquinas on confession, he
says, when a person sinned, and he doesn't distinguish here venial versus mortal sin. A person goes to confession, they've got just venial sins, a person goes to confession, they've got mortal sins, whatever. He says, do they come out at a higher level than they went in? Do they come out at the same level? And do they come out at a lower level? Like, do they return to the same state of grace they were at before they committed the sin? Or do they go to a lower level because they sinned and they get the grace? You're like kind of always going down. Or do they go into the confessional, receive the grace of confession, and come out always higher? And he says, it depends. It depends. Because you can, like, God can give you the grace in and through the experience of struggling with venial sin or grave sin, where you come out, like, at a higher and more intense level of love of God. But you can also wound yourself so you're, like, kind of limping and weaker afterwards. Or you can just, like, be restored to where you were because it was, like, a blip. But it's not entered into the structure of like how you are, who you are. And so if you put that in, like, in a more like temporal perspective, what Aquinas is saying is like the power of grace through our lives, through the cycle of living the sacramental life, confessing our sins both outside the sacrament in our examination of conscience, in our like daily life, thinking about who we are, trying to grow in friendship with God, and practice of confession, sacrament of confession. Like, we can actually dynamically, and it's not totally static or necessarily always serene. Like, I'm always going up, I'm always going up. It can be a little more unwieldy or a little more rocky, but we can basically kind of go through this gradual enlightenment and strengthening of our lives over the course of a long period of time. I mean, this is a very strange metaphor, but I mean, I'm in charge of an institution, so I have to look at the stock market. And, you know, like, you know, you watch it kind of go up and down. And it's like, that's actually a really interesting visual metaphor for our spiritual life. Like, we can go up, 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 and then, like, a little bit down, and then go up a little bit more, and then sometimes lie flat for a while. But, you know, over time, the market tends to go up. And what Aquinas is sort of saying is with the spiritual life, if you really are faithful to it years in time, over time, I mean, your heart and your mind grow closer to God. You really become more enlightened, stronger, and you're able to like deepen these virtues of faith, hope, and charity and the moral life in you and live happiness and be a person of joy, of Christian joy, and of gifts of self to other people. So, I mean, he's deeply convicted about the possibility of transformation in grace, sanctification. But he's also sober about our frailties and our need for grace without being what I would call radically pessimistic. He's not like, he thinks human nature is fundamentally good, but wounded. Okay, so I think I've actually spoken for 45 minutes.
Perfect.
Okay.
Let's thank those guys.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.